Hey everyone, welcome to Neighbor Science. I am Ryan Salisbury.
Hey everyone, I'm Peter DeVere. Welcome to Neighbor Science for today. This is episode number 3422, if I'm correct.
Oh yeah, y'all missed out on a lot. Sorry if, you know, we banked a bunch and we're not quite releasing them in order, so, you know.
Yeah, we're just basically picking episodes that... it's just episodes at random that we select and we send out.
Yeah, we flip coins until we get to the, you know, we flip enough coins to choose out of the 6,000 or so that we've done so far. It's actually quite a long process.
It is. Well, that's the way Ryan does it. I go according to Bitcoin price per minute. So, I mean, anything goes. It's the way I understand it, it's basically the most randomized algorithm in history.
Yeah, yeah. It's going to change the world. Okay, so today's topic, kind of a fun, nerdy one. It's going to be American versus Japanese heroes. Specifically, like, American superheroes versus, like, anime heroes.
And just to be clear, although I'm a big dorky geek, nerdy type dude who loves my Marvel and DC movies and all of that crap, I way prefer anime, Japanese anime,
also known as Japanime.
Japanime. And as you will see in today's episode, for anyone who might disagree, I completely respect your right to be wrong. but Goku is better than Superman. Okay, we're just going to put that out there.
I think that's going to be the uncontroversial one. I think that's the most uncontroversial one. Because Superman is not an especially popular character. You know, nobody thinks he's very deep. I don't even think we should really like spend a whole lot of time on Goku versus Superman because like a lot of people have made that comparison.
Yeah, yeah. Like, we don't want to discuss Superman's Mary Sue status too much.
But we will talk about it a little bit. We'll touch on it. But yeah, if the struggle session guys hear this episode and they want to argue about it, feel free to have us on the show.
Yeah. But, although we will have to check our schedules.
Yeah, well, you know, Leslie and I live near each other, so we could record that in person, actually. Which would be pretty cool.
Well, that's actually pretty cool. So yeah, let's argue this one.
Anyway.
anyway. Okay, so for today, where do you want to start?
Let's just start with Goku versus Superman because that's the comparison that a lot of people know, and it'll sort of get us into the swing of things.
Fair enough. Okay, so for those who don't know, you need to get a life, and by life I mean
be
reject
a weeb.
All social interaction and start watching some animated.
Watch
series.
800 episodes of a TV show that takes 20 episodes for anything to happen, but is also very good.
It really is. Like I've had so many discussions with people about this, and some people look at me and go, "I don't understand how you can like Dragon Ball Z. Nothing ever happens." I'm like, "Well, that's kind of the thing. It's this really epic story where everything happens within 5 minutes of one episode. Yeah. That you wait 10 episodes for it to get to that point, and it's just." It's amazing.
Yeah, I was thinking the other day of like, I mean, obviously I'm not going to do this because it would take way too much fucking time, but like doing like a recut of Naruto and just getting the good parts in there, like cutting all the flashbacks and all the filler. But
yeah,
you know, again,
well, then you
I do not have that much time in my
story,
life.
Then.
So one thing that I noted when I first started writing the notes for this was. There's like a common theme for all American superheroes and all Japanese heroes, which is that American superheroes all have secret identities for the most part. I mean, there's a couple exceptions, I guess, like Luke Cage.
I am Iron Man.
Iron Man. Yeah.
Although, to be fair, in the comic books, Iron Man does have a secret identity. Tony Stark doesn't come right out and say he is Iron Man. It happens. He gets exposed when he saves a little girl. In the comic books, he saves a little girl and he is exposed because he doesn't have his helmet on at the time.
Hmm. Okay.
So, yeah, that's one place where the movie's diverted a bit.
So one of the things about the secret identity is that it kind of makes the superhero character like a foil based on the existence of the villains. So this is something that like other people have talked about elsewhere. So I won't spend too much time on it. But like one of the ones that's most well known is like Batman needs the Joker, and this is explored in the movies that. You know, the Joker says that Batman needs him, and that's why Batman can never kill him. I mean, part of the reason is obviously Batman is just has like a moral code of not killing anyone. But in the same vein, Superman is said to need Lex Luthor. Like, without the villains, there's no point in the superheroes existing, so their identity kind of disintegrates. Whereas, yeah. Like, with the anime characters, you know, Goku is Goku. So Goku doesn't need Frieza in order to be Goku. He just is Goku.
Yeah, I think the major difference there is that Japanese animators have some imagination in that they can kill off one character and they can come up with another villain.
Yeah.
Whereas
wild.
The Western animation, and I don't know why, but for some reason they sort of get stuck. And they go, oh my god, I've created this fantastic villain.
You know, it's the same kind of thing as the, like, American TV show versus the anime. They, like, anime always has a story that eventually ends. And American TV shows just go on until they get canceled.
Yeah, I told you I've got some notes on the differences between the animation in the West versus the East, and one of the things that is very prevalent is essentially in the West you've got never-ending rehashes of the same story,
mm-hmm.
Whereas in the East you've got coherent stories that have a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, from my time as a scriptwriter, I can tell you that one of the fundamentals of any story is that it have a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Yeah.
And look, for once, I'm going to say that it's... You know how I absolutely loathe blaming this kind of stuff on capitalism. But I do think that it's got something to do with capitalism in that if you kill off a story arc that turns out to be popular in the beginning... there seems to be this fear that you're going to lose out on profit in the long term.
Oh, for sure. That's why that's why every movie is a sequel now. There's actually a capitalist power presentation on it, I think, by Sandy Bryan Hager. I could be wrong about that. But it's called I've Seen This Movie a Million Times. And
that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. He talks about how, like, you know, producing a new story is very risky because you have no idea whether the audience is going to go to it. But if you make, you know, the 12th fucking Wolverine movie, then you know that people are going to come see it. Or you at least know, based on the last Wolverine movie that you made, roughly how many people are going to come see it. So the risk is lower, and so you can capitalize on it more.
Indeed. So on the same line, the new Avengers movie that comes out in May, there's a number of theories that are talking about how... And this, I'm not giving a spoiler for those who think I'm not giving a spoiler alert. There's a bunch of theories saying that Marvel's problem over the last 10 years has been that they've made these one-dimensional villains that don't go anywhere. They're one movie wonders, and it's kind of weak storytelling and all of that. But now the theory is that Thanos is going to bring all the villains from the previous movies, not all of them, but quite a few of them, is going to bring them back into the fold. So we're going to see Red Skull again, and we're going to see... basically, it's just this big rehash of everything. So it is this continuous rehash versus a proper story. And now this also relates to another big theme within Western versus Eastern storytelling. In Western stories, you've got the superheroes and the heroes. They all have this singular power, and it's a gift that they get. In Batman's case, it's money. In Superman's case, it's the strength he gains from the sun. In Flash, he gets this gift by being struck by lightning. Yeah, yeah. And so in all these superheroes in the Western culture, it's this thing that they've just gotten. And it's sort of like, hey, look how lucky you are. And
yeah, I guess there's a couple exceptions, like Hot Girl, Martian Manhunter.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But yeah. At the same time, you go across to the East, and what you get there is the characters in general. Obviously, I'm generalizing here. There are exceptions, but the character has
they get power from doing their best.
That this is it is they identify a need within themselves, and as part of the ongoing story, they grow, they learn, they train, they do amazing things to achieve the next level of power and the next level of power and the next level of power. And it's always about improving and it's always about getting better. Whereas in the West, that improvement, there's a cap on that. There's, except obviously for Superman, who has been changed so many frickin' times, it's insane. For anyone who thinks that I'm talking shit, go look up Superman Prime 1 million. No, I'm dead serious. This is a Superman that has lived for 50,000 years in the heart of the sun and has emerged as this godlike being who is... He was basically written so that he can't be beaten anymore. because fans were going... But we can beat him with this, and we can beat him with that.
Yeah, Goku
could
beat him
with this. Yeah, but Goku could always beat him. So whatever.
So let's start in on the Goku versus Superman comparison. Let's just get it out of the way.
Okay, you do Superman. I'll do Goku.
Okay.
Okay.
So I'll start with the similarities between them. So they're both aliens. They're both the most powerful being on Earth. They're both inveterate do-gooders, so, you know, they both are, like, they're always the good guy. So I will say the differences. Goku, like a lot of other anime characters, has former villains as friends. So, like, Vegeta and Piccolo are two of his best friends, and they were both characters that started as villains. Piccolo started as a villain in Dragon Ball, and then Vegeta, obviously, in Dragon Ball Z. So that's one thing. You know, sometimes he turns people to his side, sometimes he defeats them.
This is, for me, it's always been the biggest draw of the Dragon Ball Z series, is the fact that they teach that no one is irredeemable.
Yeah. I mean, Frieza and Cell are. But like,
well,
Boo
to
is.
To a certain extent,
yeah,
but even Frieza and Cell have, throughout the stories, there have been moments when there's been the possibility, but they have been swayed back to their evil ways. Mm-hmm. As an audience member, you sit there the whole time, and it's not just, oh, I want to see how the hero beats the bad guy. It actually becomes a case of wanting to see how they go about persuading the other person to join their side.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this a psychological, social dynamic that isn't present in Western...
Western...
Except for the Flash.
Heroes.
The Flash is forever trying...
Okay.
He always thinks that he can turn them into good people.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's
for
cool.
For some reason.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I didn't think about that.
Although,
to
be fair, I'm talking about the Flash comic books. Please, I'm never talking about the CW series. Never, ever, because I loved the first season. I was okay with the second. By the third, I was shaking my head. And now for the fourth season, I don't know. I feel like they're pissing on me.
I stopped watching after the first season. Like, I started the second one. It got too repetitive. Anyway,
dude, it's gotten so much worse. Anyway.
So another thing about Goku, and this is kind of giving away the comparison with Superman, which is he does not ally with systems of power. So, like, he doesn't help the cops or the government at all. He's just kind of his own force. Like, you know, he's like Team Earth. And then finally, in here I have he'll kill if he has to in order to prevent further suffering. So, like, he did kill Frieza. He did kill Cell because, you know, they could not be brought to his side. And they were going to, you know, kill millions of people or billions.
Yeah, he's a big picture kind of guy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Whereas Superman is like, oh my god, I can't do it. I cannot do it.
I'm the Boy Scout. I can't.
Big blue Boy Scout, Mary Sue.
all right. So should we just move on to the next character set?
Yeah. Why not?
Okay.
Why not?
Okay.
I think we've covered Superman and Goku enough.
Okay.
Anyone who doesn't agree with our debate are welcome to go look it up online. There's millions of pages dedicated to explaining why Goku is better.
So the next one I'll do, this one's kind of weird, and it's not going to be what people expect. The Western character is going to be Sherlock Holmes. The Eastern character is going to be Ginkgo from Mushishi. And I know a lot of people would just think, like, why don't you do, like, L or Detective Conan for that comparison?
I prefer the Ginkgo, to be honest.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, first of all, you know, Ginkgo is also a detective character. Second of all, I think L is just, like, too weird of a character for me to want to do. Like, I didn't really like him that much, and then I've never seen Detective Conan, so... I think Mushishi is a vastly better series than Death Note. If you haven't seen it, it's fucking great. You can learn all about Shinto because it's kind of an allegory for the Shinto religion. But yeah, so Sherlock, he's always like the smartest person in the room. You know, we've all seen at least like the Sherlock TV series or the movies with, RDJ. So we know Sherlock he's always the smartest person in the room. He uses deductive powers to solve thefts and murders in order to put away the bad guy. Because of that focus, he tends to help the wealthy and powerful, often putting away like the downtrodden for their criminal acts. So like some of the people that he puts away are, you know, they're poor people versus like, you know, not, I mean, some of the stories he puts away rich people, but not all of them. And he views the criminals as villains, not really caring about their motivations outside of like, why did they do it, so that he can solve the mystery of what happened. And he's always characterized as being very arrogant and unlikable. He does drugs, which is pretty cool, but you know, he's kind of an asshole. And he only does what he does for like personal fulfillment. You know, he's really smart, so he could like make more money doing something else, which they talk about in the TV series a couple times. And then he's a very sedentary character. He always lives at 221B and just travels around, but he always returns to that spot. So Ginkgo, on the other hand, he is not depicted as having greater intelligence than anyone else. So he's not an asshole about being smart. but he does have an encyclopedic knowledge of Mushi, which are like the spirit sort of creatures in the show. And so he uses that knowledge to fix physiological, psychological, and environmental problems caused by the Mushi in the various villages that he travels to. And he tends to help the downtrodden specifically because they're the ones that are more likely to fall victim to Mushi. So, you know, he helps, like, people who are going blind or deaf, people who live in villages where, you know, before they were starving and now they're not because of Mushi, or before they had plenty of food and now they are starving because of Mushi. So he's almost always helping people who are truly in need and not just people who had their sack of gems stolen or whatever. And though the Mushi cause harm to humans, and this is, different by virtue of, you know, the antagonist being like a non-human creature versus a human. So it's not like a totally fair comparison with Sherlock, but he views the antagonist as like something that's morally neutral and just trying to survive. So
strong differences, really.
Yeah, yeah.
And then what I like about both characters, Ginkgo does, I know he smokes.
Yeah. Yeah, he smokes mushy cigarettes. Which I think means blunt.
Yeah. So both of them are depicted as having a kind of substance abuse problem.
Mm-hmm.
Although in both cases, it's not really depicted as a problem.
Mm-hmm.
In Sherlock's case, not so much in the series, obviously, with Benedict Cucumber Patch. in his series, cigarettes are it, and he taunts himself with them, and they get hidden from him, and so on and so forth. But in the original books, he's actually
a big cokehead, right?
Very heavily opiates of almost any sort. Opium specifically is his big weakness, but again, not really a weakness. He would spend days and days when bored because he doesn't have a case to solve, just wallowing in opiates. But they never seem to dull him when it comes to doing any kind of case. And this to me is interesting because, you know, if we look at pretty much any kind of modern storyline, the moment there's any kind of drugs involved or there's any kind of substance involved, it's always depicted as a heavy negative. And
yeah, they're all weepy and shit. Yeah, it's terrible.
Yeah. I've been very clean for a year now.
By law.
By law, yeah. But and I've said this to you before. I've been enjoying having a clear head for a year or so. But at the same time, I would like a release from time to time. And I have to say, I don't feel like my intelligence has ever been dulled by the fact that I smoked copious amounts of marijuana back in the day. I'm still able to hold conversations. I'm perfectly socialized. I don't have issues because I smoked a lot of pot. And this for me is interesting that these two characters very specifically are depicted as relatively high functioning people. Although Sherlock isn't he's not socially adept or anything. He's a bit blunt, he's a bit rude.
I almost think he's supposed to be autistic, but they didn't have the language to talk about that back then.
Yeah, I think in the series they try and pass him off as a high functioning sociopath.
Mm-hmm.
Because that kind of sociopathy is people. It's very poorly misunderstood.
Mm-hmm.
Very poorly understood. We're actually surrounded by sociopaths all the time. People that have poorly functioning mirror neurons in their brain surround us. People have different levels of ability when it comes to empathy with those around them. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you can't do a job. These people make fantastic surgeons and terrible CEOs. So I find it very interesting. And of the characters that you put on the list to take a look at and discuss, these two are easily, I could chat about them for hours.
Yeah.
Not that we're going to.
Yeah. One more thing I will say about, about Ginkgo is that, he's a cursed character. So if you've never seen the series, I won't spoil like the source of all this, but like, basically, he always has to move from village to village. He's a complete nomad because if he stays in any one place for too long, he starts attracting more and more mushy and like more and more harmful ones. So he stays on the move in order to prevent harming other people. But as a result, you know, he has no home. But at the same time, he does, because he travels so much, he goes to the same place like more than once, you know, in his life. And so he sees people that he's helped in the past, and they're always extremely happy to see him. Like, he's like one of the, their most beloved people, even though they only interact for, you know, a small amount of time.
Fair enough. Now that you're actually mentioning it, while you were speaking, I think an even better comparison than Sherlock Holmes would be John Constantine.
I don't know who that is.
You don't know who John Constantine is?
No.
Oh my god. That? John Constantine is
that some Bible shit?
DC character.
Okay.
yeah. DC character. Uh-huh. In the DC comic books, he's this British exorcist.
Oh, that's cool.
And also major smoking thing.
Uh-huh.
He's always got a cigarette. He was played in an American movie by Keanu Reeves.
Oh, nice.
And the movie wasn't. Yeah, the movie wasn't terrible or anything, although it didn't hit home with fans who didn't like the... I mean, I loved it. I thought it was great. But, yeah, the movie didn't get good reviews. It didn't get a good reception by audiences.
Well, that's a shame.
It is, because at the end of the day, I thought Keanu did a relatively good job. But John Constantine... he's got this very cursed vibe to him. He's not a very nice guy. Mm-hmm. He's a bit of an asshole.
Okay.
So in that sense, he's a lot more like Sherlock. But he's also got this very cursed vibe to him, and doesn't socialize well, struggles. He's very well known in the underworld, in the underground scene, and also very sought after by demons and whatnot. So... yeah, the moment you started talking about Ginkgo and his curse, it reminds me a lot of John Constantine. So there's another good comparison.
Interesting. Okay. sorry, I have a
bad recommend this you, morning. I recommend that you check out the movie,
okay.
To be honest.
Okay. So I'm wondering who we should move on to, because I have to leave in about... 20 minutes.
Well, okay, so let's just very quickly do Punisher and Guts.
Okay, so do you know much about these characters?
I do. Okay. Punisher...
I've only seen the Punisher series, and then I actually haven't watched any of Berserk, really.
The two previous... Okay, well, I haven't watched a whole lot of Berserk, but I did read one of the manga comic books, and I quite enjoyed it. I just never...
One of my really good friends raves about it, and so I do want to get to it sometime, but yeah.
So in Berserk, Guts is also known as Black Swordsman, and he's a former mercenary who has been branded a wanderer. Who travels the world and is in constant struggle between pursuing his own ends and protecting those that he loves. At one time, he was driven solely by his will to survive. And because of this, he finds purpose in life eventually when he joins this kind of gang called the Band of the Falcon. And... He really helps that gang that, I don't like using the word gang, the faction.
I love using that word.
He helps them, faction, yes. He greatly helps the faction with all of their storied successes during, in Berserk, there's the 100-year war. And he ends up becoming the Falcon Raiders' captain. Mm-hmm. He eventually becomes dissatisfied with, like, clinging to this dream that drives him throughout. And he leaves the Falcons in pursuit of his own kind of dream. The thing that I was reading was called The Eclipse. And it's this really, really heavy... section of the book, like horrible stuff that happens, and because of everything that happens there, he embarks on this 2-year war against the God Hand and the Apostles, and becomes throughout the story, he becomes more and more embittered, and he takes on this one-track quest for retribution.
And I think that's what the basis of this comparison is. Because I put the two together. I'm sure that you probably would have as well. But they're both basically like violence and vengeance incarnate. You know, they're like the most violent characters in their respective canon.
Yeah. Then you go look at the Punisher, and look, there are various different origin stories. You saw the series, and the series he's depicted as a former military, an army ranger. I can't remember.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas in the original comic books, he was a cop.
Oh, okay. So that's why cops love him. Okay.
Because I was watching
the series, so, I was like, why do all the fucking cops love this guy? Like, what the fuck? He's not even one of them.
He's got in the original comic book series, the original two movies, as well as in the new series, his family gets killed by a drug cartel.
Okay.
And he then goes out and kills everyone associated with it in any kind of way. the TV series, the new one, basically picks up at the end of all of that. He's done all his killing. He's killed off the entire cartel. And now you start to see that the drug cartel was actually working for the CIA as part of their heroin smuggling in Afghanistan. And all that
very cool detail. Very realistic detail.
Very realistic detail. Yeah, people don't seem to know too much about it. But I'm also, like, that's not our focus today, so I don't want to get into it too much. Essentially, he is driven one-minded, one-track. He is out for vengeance. He is out to punish those who have done him wrong.
I do love when he punishes people.
Oh, my goodness.
It's pretty cool.
I'm not going to lie. This series was one of my favorite of the last 2 years or so.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was definitely one of the best shows of 2017, easily. In fact, I can't think of a better one.
Yeah. Did it make our list?
It did, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it did. At that point, I hadn't finished watching it yet. I've just recently finished watching it, and the only thing about the series that I hated was the very last kind of 5 minutes of the series.
Oh, yeah.
Where they sort of... It just... Bleh.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, what? No! Come on! At least give me a cliffhanger.
Yeah.
The two characters, perfect comparison.
Yeah.
I don't even think, except obviously for the fact that in Berserk, there's more of a, it's not the nuclear family concept that is the big feature of the Punisher series. It's got more to do with overall, hatred and bitterness for Guts.
Yeah.
Other than that, the two stories are very, very, very similar.
Yeah. Side note, I have always hated AMVs because they're always like some Dragon Ball Z fight to like Linkin Park or Evanescence or some shit. But there is a extremely good AMV based on Berserk that uses some trashy white SoundCloud rap. These guys, Suicide Boys, and I love it. I've watched it so many fucking times. I'm gonna link it in the description. It's like a perfect music video. It's so fucking cool.
Awesome! I can't wait to check that out.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, there's Linkin Park. Did a song, I can't remember exactly what the name of the song is, but it's gonna bother me. The music video that they did was basically this kid that walks around in a riot in what looks like Eastern Europe somewhere.
Uh-huh.
And at the peak of the song, at the climax of the song, the kid pulls a Goku where he basically he screams almost like he's going Super Saiyan, and the rocks around him start floating, and people are blown back by the sheer force of his scream. And
they have always been really big into anime. That's actually I liked them when I was in middle school, obviously, because I was a white kid in middle school. But the thing that attracted me to them was, like, I was in Best Buy, I saw their album, and they had a giant robot on it, and I was like, oh shit, that's fucking cool, I gotta listen to whatever that is.
And you did.
Yeah.
Like all the other white people.
Yep.
I'm not gonna lie.
Many hours at the skating rink listening to Linkin Park.
Yeah, my wife has recently put a whole bunch of, well, pretty much all the Linkin Park songs onto a USB, and I listen to it while I drive to work and home again. And man, it's been really awesome just going down that trip of memory lane. So yeah.
All right, so we got a little bit more time. I want to get into Luke Skywalker versus Amuro Ray, because I haven't watched any of the Gundam series in a long time, but I was watching a ton of clips of Amuro Ray, so I could get a better, like, refamiliarize myself with this character, because I think this is a really good comparison.
Sure.
You know, Gundam was heavily inspired by Star Wars. It came out, the original Star Wars movie came out only about 2 years before Gundam was released, which is why the year it was 0079, you know, that's about when it came out. So the obvious similarities, they're both ace pilots. They both use lightsabers. They both use the Force. They both fight. Their main villain is a guy in a samurai helmet. And they're both kind of like the chosen one in their respective series. So I think Luke is, you know, he's supposed to be like the kind of typical teenager that we're supposed to identify with. Whereas Amuro Ray is like more of an outsider character. So Luke, you know, immediately is, you know, he like bonds with Han Solo and some of the other characters. Like he bonds with Obi-Wan, and Amuro, on the other hand, he's kind of a loner. I mean, they're both nerds, but like Amuro's more of like a shut-in nerd. He's not quite like a Hikikomori character where like he completely shuts himself off, but you know, he feels very alienated from the rest of his crew in the beginning of the series. But on the other hand, he's a very like caring and altruistic person, because you know, there are these war orphans on the white base, the ship that they fly on, and he pretty much immediately it like becomes sort of like a brother or father figure to them. I would say I think Luke is probably a more memorable character based on the fact that I had to go back and like refamiliarize myself with, you know, Amuro's interactions with people. And
I think that might also have to do with the fact that Star Wars has definitely reached cult status.
Yeah.
And the character of Luke Skywalker is it's very, very strongly mimetic.
Yeah.
It was designed to be as mimetic as possible in essence. George Lucas wasn't mucking around when he wrote the character, when he designed the character. So yeah, I mean, I don't think Amuro Ray is necessarily less memorable. It's just that we've been bombarded with Luke Skywalker our entire lives.
Yeah, I will say though, based on how Luke has developed in The Last Jedi, I think Amuro's,
which I loved.
Yeah, I do think though that Amuro's like adult. More adult character, like past the original series, I think his character development is quite a bit better, especially in Char's Counterattack. He's not only like an extremely, extremely capable fighter, very, very resourceful. You know, he fights in the way that like, you know, some super soldier would. But he's also like there's also like a major philosophical conflict, which you don't see as much in Star Wars. Star Wars is just kind of purely like good versus evil, whereas Gundam, the whole series, like the Universal Century, is like explicitly fascism and anti-fascism, because Zeon's core ideology is a heavily fascistic ideology. It's sort of based on Nazism, but it's like kind of a very unique take on it. So like they have new types, which are the human evolution that happens in space, which manifests in the series as like someone with essentially psychic powers, which is, you know, the equivalent of the Untermensch. And then there's also and I think we could bring a guest on here to talk about this sometime, Josh Burke. He's very into this, not into Nazism, but into the fact that there's this heavy philosophy in Gundam. But the other major part is called Kantalism, and it's the idea that humans are like a parasite on Earth and should leave the Earth and go into space and let the Earth be this like pristine nature like sanctuary. And so in Char's Counterattack, Char's who is the equivalent of Darth Vader, Char is heavily following through with this philosophy, and you know a lot of the characters throughout the series do, but in this one he's trying to drop like a huge like mining colony or like asteroid based colony on the Earth in order to kill everyone so that the Earth can regenerate itself and become like this pristine nature reserve. And so Amuro actually like sort of has like a philosophical battle with him, like, you know, humans are not parasites, like you're insane, blah blah blah. It's very cool. So I think early Luke Skywalker is a better character, but late Amuro Ray is also a better character because they don't get that deep into like the philosophical weeds with the Force Awakens or The Last Jedi. I think for obvious reasons, because it's Disney.
Obviously, you've told me before you don't really like reading fiction.
I would just prefer to spend my time reading nonfiction.
Fair enough. Like, no judgment or anything. The one thing I will say is that for Star Wars, since they split the written books into what is now considered canon and what is now considered the Legends universe, there are stories involving Luke in the Legends universe, in the books, that will blow your mind. The depth of the stories in the Legends universe are amazing.
Okay.
I'm not that familiar with Gundam Wing. I've watched it, but
Wing is not in the same universe.
A couple of times. Yeah.
Yeah, there's the Universal Century, and then there's the After Century. I don't remember what the fuck. I don't really like Gundam Wing that much. I liked it when it was airing on Toonami when I was a kid, but it's too like Bishonen for me now.
Fair enough.
Yeah, but the Universal Century is similar. Like, you know, if you watch Gundam Wing, it's more like the Star Wars movies, and then if you watch the Universal Century stuff, it's more like what you're talking about. Very, very deep. My absolute favorite is Gundam 0080, and it's just an OVA, so I would recommend anyone who hasn't seen much of Gundam watch this one, because it's only 6 episodes. It's not about any of the characters that are in the rest of the series, so like Amuro's not in there, Char's not in there. It's all unique characters, and it basically like it's like a mix between like a slice of life story and like a war story. So like it follows this kid who meets a soldier from Zeon and befriends him, and then also meets a soldier from the Space Federation and befriends her, and then gets in the middle of this conflict between the two on his colony. And like it's a absolutely heart-wrenching story, great animation, great characters, and like I said, only 6 episodes, so you can watch it in a day, really. If you have 3 hours, you can watch, or yeah, 3 hours, you can watch it.
Okay.
Cool. And then my second recommendation, if you liked that, watch either the original series or Zeta Gundam. I think those are the two best Universal Century ones. I haven't seen any of the new ones, like any ones made after like Wing, so those might be good as well. I've heard pretty good things, but I couldn't get into them. Okay.
Fair enough.
So I think we probably have time for one more. Do you have a choice of what you'd like to do?
Yeah, I think let's have a quick chat about Captain America versus Naruto.
Oh, that's what? No, we can't get into that. We don't. There's no time.
Too long.
Yeah, because that's what I want. That's what I want to be like the meat of everything.
Okay.
Because I wrote so much about Naruto.
Cool. Well then, look, Spider-Man versus Monkey D. Luffy. Although I'm not that familiar with Monkey D. Luffy.
Okay. So One Piece is great. I don't know if they make movies. If they make movies, maybe you should check one of those out. But yeah, he's one of my favorite characters ever. Actually, like all the main characters in that show are fucking great. So Monkey D. Luffy is from One Piece. If you're not an anime head, everyone knows Spider-Man. So like we already know his origin story, thanks to it being in like basically every Spider-Man property ever made. he's a great character. I love Spider-Man. He's like the wisecracking, web-slinging, nerdy kid from Queens.
Please note, we're talking about Peter Parker and not Miles Morales.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't know the difference. None of them Morales are alternate characters.
No, he's just the new Spider-Man.
Okay.
He also got bitten by a radioactive spider, but it's a different story.
What a damn coincidence. both characters get their powers by accident. So Luffy, likewise, he's a loudmouth kid. He's kind of from a backwater town, though. He's not from the city like Peter. But he accidentally eats a devil fruit, which is it's like the device. It's a like a special type of fruit in the One Piece universe that gives you special powers. So he, as a kid, accidentally ate one just because he loves food. He's very similar to Goku in the amount that he eats. You know, like he's always depicted eating awesome. Like giant like dinosaur bones in like 3 seconds. that's one of my favorite archetypes in Japanese characters. Is like the hero that just eats insane amounts of food. And like that's where like, I mean, it makes sense, you know, they're like super powered characters, like they have like all this crazy strength and they use up all this energy, so like of course they would have to eat like horrendous amounts of food. And they make it extra funny in One Piece because Luffy is a rubber man, so he's Mr. Fantastic.
Yeah.
He's a lot like Mr. Fantastic, except he's more like cartoonish, I guess. So when he eats the crazy amounts of food, he like gets gigantic. You know, he's like this big ball. It's very funny. So that's Luffy's origin. I think both characters are like lovable loudmouth orphans. They both swing around, which is like kind of a superficial detail, but both of their powers let them like swing around places, and they help average people. Like that's one of my favorite things about Spider-Man is that he helps regular people instead of stopping bank robberies or shit like that. The major difference: Spider-Man is like a traditional good guy, although the Daily Bugle, right? Daily Bugle. They're constantly trying to paint him as a villain, and a lot of times he is painted as a villain, but he's very obviously the good guy to most people. But Luffy, on the other hand, is a traditional bad guy because he's a pirate captain, and so there's like a 300 million their currency is berries, 300 million berry bounty on Luffy at the point in the series that I'm in. So when people meet him and they know who he is, they're like completely scared of him. They think that he's going to like rob or kill them. There's people who impersonate him to, you know, in order to like steal from people, like using his reputation to force other people to do things like under the threat of the violence that they can't actually enact on them.
So he's basically a superpowered Jack Sparrow.
Jack Sparrow. No, not really. No, they're not. I don't think their personalities are not really comparable at all. You know, Jack Sparrow is kind of like a he's drunky D. Luffy. No, Jack is very selfish. Luffy is extremely empathetic. He's kind of like Naruto in that he immediately accepts people. You know, if they're not doing something like morally revolting, he like immediately accepts people. There's a character Brook who's he's a skeleton, and so most people are like terrified of him. And you know, when Luffy meets him, he's like, "Oh my god, that's so cool! You're a skeleton. Want to join my crew?"
Fair enough. I like it.
Yeah. And I think they're both outstanding characters, both very lovable, and they both are people who, you know, help the average downtrodden person. I think we could talk more about it, but it's getting very close to when I have to leave.
Okay. Are we going to pretend that it's just one ongoing episode and you're going to cut
out? Fuck no. We probably stopped very suddenly yesterday, so I don't think that's going to work.
This is not us continuing from yesterday.
Yeah, so we're back. I'm going to turn my game down a little bit. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, like, geez, dude, there's no need to shout at me. I don't feel like I did anything wrong.
Yeah, so basically yesterday I overslept for the first time in a while and had to drop my car off so that my tires don't go flat again, get my tires replaced. So I had to run out all of a sudden. So if we stopped kind of in the middle of a conversation, now you know why. A little insider baseball for you there.
I'm not going to lie. I thought it was very rude. And Ryan only told me about this once he'd finished leaving.
I got there about 5 minutes early, so I could have done a more polite exit, but I decided to bully you instead. So I'm gonna cut out all the part where, you know, I scream racial slurs at you, but you know, it's still pretty rude even without that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I cried myself to sleep last night. My wife was a little bit worried. But I mean, it's not like it's a rare thing for me to cry myself to sleep at night.
Yeah, and she already hates me, so you know, it's cool.
It's cool. Okay, so now we're going to discuss Captain America versus Naruto.
Yeah, so this is the real reason I wanted to do this episode, was because I finished the 500th episode of Naruto Shippuden the other day. I did not watch them all, so I haven't spent that much time on it, but I watched the whole series. I skipped all the filler, I skipped a lot of the flashbacks.
So basically, you have not been following the advice of Pokemon by catching them all.
No. And if anyone has ever been interested in that show, I highly recommend looking up a list of the filler episodes. Very few of them are good. There's one that I actually wrote a bunch of notes about, like a a small story arc about Hagoromo and Haruma Otsutsuki. It's very good. It's around episode 464, so I'd recommend watching those. But all the other ones, skip that shit. It's dumb. They like, you know, they'll be in the middle of a fight where like the world is ending, and then they'll suddenly cut to like, oh, we're all fine now, and we're all on this fun ninja mission that's gonna have lots of comedy in it. It's like, it's ruining the pacing of the show. Like, what the fuck?
Well, I suppose no one ever gave the Japanese classes on how to tell stories in the Western tradition.
That's the problem.
Yeah, that's
their,
the problem.
Their racially inferior storytelling ability.
Okay. Yeah, so having watched all of Naruto somewhat, give us a breakdown.
So Captain America versus Naruto, I was at a bar yesterday and talking to one of the regulars there, and he thought this comparison was very strange. You know, he's kind of an anime guy, so he knows about Naruto and obviously knows about Captain America. So he's asking me why, but I was like kind of drunk and couldn't really explain it well because I didn't have my notes in front of me. but I swore the comparison was good. So
I know what I'm talking about. I just can't like, explain it to you properly.
No, they're like both. They're both like really nationalist, man. Like, come on, like fuck. That was basically my answer. So the reason I think they're a good comparison is they both strive to represent their nation, even though Naruto's is a fake nation called Konohagakure. And they're both weak initially, but were given immense power from someone else. They're both heavily thematic, and like nearly everything about them represents the values their stories have at their center. So Captain America was born to a poor immigrant family in America. We probably know the story, the origin story, because we've seen the movie, but I'll go over it anyway. He decided to enlist in the military after being horrified by what the Axis nations were doing in World War II. He was too frail to enlist, but he was brought into a secret program that gave him the Super Soldier Serum, which gave him powers. He is given his signature vibranium shield by President Roosevelt. He fights alongside his best friend Bucky, another patriotic soldier. They both fight in World War II and, you know, beat up Nazis, and then they're both frozen until the modern era. When they reawaken, Cap joins the Avengers while Bucky is captured by the Red Menace. And I'm not talking about the Red Skull, but the Soviet Union. Cap later discovers corruption in the U.S. government and changes his identity to fight against it, fights against it, and then goes back to being Captain America eventually. So with the exception of the part where they were frozen, every one of these story details is also a thematic detail. Captain America represents the dream of the United States, the child of a poor immigrant who became one of the greatest people alive. His motivation for fighting is nationalist. His power was given to him by the state and by Western chemical science. His iconic weapon is ostensibly defensive, much like our military, but regularly used offensively, much like our military, and given him to him by the president. His friend is brainwashed and turned into the bad kind of super soldier, Winter Soldier, which we are also familiar with, by the commies and by Eastern cybernetic science, which is evil, unlike Western chemical science. When Cap realizes the U.S. government is doing evil, it's merely a corruption of their once good principles, and then once that corruption is rooted out, he goes right back to being America.
America.
Yeah. What do you think about that analysis?
I think it's pretty spot on. Obviously, it doesn't take into account the latest little twist in the Cap saga in the last year and a half.
Yeah, is that canon?
It is, but Marvel has changed things up a bit to explain why he has essentially taken the side of Hydra in recent turns. Okay. Basically, just as a quick explanation, there's a comic book episode that came out, I think, beginning of last year, more or less, where Captain America reveals that he is an agent of Hydra and has been all along. And I mean, a billion memes sprang up from this within the nerd universe. And essentially, it's all because of this little girl who is possessed by a demon who has brainwashed him into believing that he is an agent of Hydra. And
what?
Marvel has really... I don't know what the fuck they're doing with
That's
this.
That's so
but
fucking
anyway.
Stupid.
Yeah, it's complicated. But in my opinion, overcomplicated in an attempt to try and justify their stupid shift in the storyline.
Yeah, it sounds like they thought of that afterwards.
Yeah, kind of like the next 2-3 years, they might push through with that storyline, and then in about 10 years' time, they're going to rehash things to make it as if the last 5 years have never happened.
Yeah.
which is what Marvel does whenever they do a story that they realize was stupid and doesn't work. I like your analysis. I 100% agree with the statism stance of Captain America. What's interesting is that in Captain America, Winter Soldier, and then later Civil War movies, he takes on a very libertarian stance in rejecting the state and everything.
But that was again, I think, because he saw them as corrupt and not because he was fundamentally against the state or the U.S.
The Sokovia Accords or anything like that. Yeah. No, he's
it's not like he went against them because of the Iraq War or any shit like that, you know?
Yeah. It's once again, it's a direct thing of him saying that it's corruption of the once good principles of the state. And obviously,
I bet it was really just because they sent him a fucking income tax bill, and he was like, this is slavery!
What do you mean, back to the 40s? I have outstanding taxes from when I was frozen? What the fuck, people? Well, sir, your social security card says right here that you've been alive since the 1940s, and obviously we need that revenue.
This is literal violence!
Taxpayer dollars.
Okay, so Naruto was born to the leader of a ninja village. His parents died sealing a demon inside of him, which led to him being an outcast and perpetually lonely. When he is befriended by a teacher, Iruka-sensei, he decides to become leader of the village and make everyone acknowledge him. He has no natural ability, but thanks to his persistence and empathy, he defeats much more powerful enemies than himself by accepting and befriending them. So he's even more of Goku than Goku is. His best friend Sasuke succumbs to resentment and rejection of others and leaves the village to become more powerful by himself. Sasuke becomes one of the most powerful ninja through personal trauma and using others for his own ends, which fueled his powers. Naruto becomes one of the most powerful ninja by befriending the demon inside of himself, as well as the 8 other demons like it, as well as everyone that he ever comes across, essentially. Sasuke eventually desires to dominate everyone else and tries to kill Naruto, but at that point they were so equally matched that they both deal a final blow to one another and lose their arms. And so Sasuke finally acknowledges Naruto.
It kind of sounds like Naruto just goes around going, come on, let's just be friends.
he kind of does. He does fight a lot. So he does beat the shit out of people, but he's also like, even after he defeats someone, he's like, can you be my friend now? Can you like realize what you're doing was like the wrong thing to do? And like, you know, you're pushing people away and you're not going to accomplish the goal you're going to accomplish. Not only because, you know, doing what you're doing is not going to accomplish it, but also because I'm just going to beat you again. he fights in that kind of way, which is really cool.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. So again, each of those story details contain thematic details. Naruto is the son of one of the greatest ninja in the village's history, but has no natural talent himself. So kind of like the anti Ubermensch story, like kind of an anti-fascist narrative on human genetics. Without the initial help of that one person reaching out to him, he could have easily suffered alone, eventually lashing out and hurting others like Sasuke and so many of the other antagonists did. Naruto fights with his fists, but not to dominate others like Sasuke or Captain America, but to knock sense into the person he's fighting as a fellow person who once suffered the way that they did. Sasuke fights with his fists as well, but aims for dominance, and as a result, plunges himself ever further into despair and loneliness. Naruto never gives up on Sasuke, so even though they are equally powerful, Naruto's friendliness eventually pierces through Sasuke's loneliness.
Aww. It's such a beautiful story.
I know. I cried so much throughout the series. So my overall judgment, I haven't read the comic version of either series, I'll have to admit, but I've been comparing. I've used Captain America's like summary from the comics and, you know, the knowledge of the MCU movies, and then I'm comparing it to the Naruto anime. So the Captain America movies are more fun to watch because, one, they're more concise, two, they're better paced, and three, they're more accessible, obviously, to American audiences. But Naruto is a deeply, deeply superior story, not only because I'm an internationalist communist and disagree with Captain America's themes and values, but also because Naruto's themes are represented powerfully and consistently in both the overall story as well as the episodic stories, the ones that aren't filler, anyway. Both series have very cool action sequences, but the most memorable parts are when Naruto empathizes with his enemies and sees the pain motivating them to hurt others. And it has outstanding visual and thematic depictions of isolation, which is something a lot of us can relate to today.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, every time I think of the, like, ending of the fight between Naruto and Gaara, which is in the original Naruto series, not Shippuden, I start choking up. It's really fucking sad.
Well, now I don't want to watch it. I don't like crying in movies.
Okay. So I can talk about the overall narrative to kind of further recommend it to people. Should I do the long version or the short version?
Let's test our audience and see if they are paying proper attention by going with the overall long narrative.
Okay.
Instead of the short one, and anyone who's still around at the end of the episode is a diehard fan.
we'll put out a quiz question, and if you could tweet the answer to the Neighbor Science account correctly, then you win a prize. I don't know, like a manor or something. Don't skip ahead. That's cheating. We will figure out somehow that you've done that.
And, we've got advanced tracking software embedded in our podcast, people. Don't fuck with us.
Yeah. I've been using all your webcams to spy for black hat hackers, by the way. So let me look. Okay, the story of Naruto starts in ancient times when there was no magic. Two objects fell from space. One was the seed of the divine tree, and the other was a woman named Kaguya Otsutsuki. That name's so hard to say. She becomes the concubine of a local ruler who falls in love with him. And falls in love with him and her handmaiden. Her master gets involved in a land dispute with another state. She kills some soldiers from the state when they try to kidnap her. And her master, in order to stop the impending war with the other state, tries to kill Kaguya and in the process kills Kaguya's handmaiden. Kaguya gets enraged, eats a fruit from the divine tree, and gains the power of chakra, which is like the magic in the series. Which she uses to imprison both sides of the conflict in the infinite Tsukuyomi, an illusion spell that imprisons them in a cocoon attached to the divine tree. Kaguya becomes a goddess with her chakra powers, but she's a tyrannical one, using her supreme power to keep herself in a position of supreme authority. She has two sons, Hagoromo and Hamura, who discover that she has been putting ever more people into the infinite Tsukuyomi, including someone from the village they live in who they were friends with, and that the divine tree will eventually suck all the life out of the land and people. Her sons being the only... Oh, did you have something to say?
No.
Okay.
All good.
Oh, it sounded like you unmuted yourself. Okay. Her sons being the only other people with chakra fight back against Kaguya. She turns the divine tree into the Ten Tails, a powerful chakra-using beast. Eventually, they defeat her, seal her away in the moon, and split the Ten Tails into 9 tailed beasts. Hagoromo, the elder son and sage of the Six Paths, creates a philosophy called Ninshu that seeks to use chakra to connect people together for mutual understanding and cooperation. So here's the part that's the core story. Hagoromo, as well, has two sons, Indra and Ashura. Indra is a natural genius with chakra, inventing ninjutsu, the spells that modern shinobi like Naruto and Sasuke use chakra for. Ashura, on the other hand, is clumsy and average, only being able to succeed by relying on the help of others. Hagoromo gives them each a test to decide who should be the successor to Ninshu, i.e. the new Sage of the Six Paths. Each has to help a town that was formerly water scarce, but is now supplied by a piece of the divine tree, which is also poisoning them. Indra completes the test quickly using his superior power, forcing the townspeople to destroy the divine tree using ninjutsu. Ashura spends a year getting the townspeople to help him dig a well, destroy the divine tree, and then heals the afflicted with his limited ninjutsu abilities. He returns with a large number of the townspeople that he helped and is named the successor to Ninshu by Hagoromo. Indra is enraged. He perfects the power of the Sharingan, which is like his visual power. Like it's like the source of like illusion magic and a bunch of other powers. So he kills his two friends, which awaken the Mangekyo Sharingan, which is the more powerful version of it, and attacks Ashura. Ashura is given the power of all the villagers and the power of the Sage of the Six Paths by Hagoromo, and eventually defeats Indra. Indra then vows to destroy Ninshu through reincarnation. Several of the main characters of the series are reincarnations of Indra and Ashura. Sasuke is Indra, and Naruto is Ashura. Naruto is an orphan who has the nine tails sealed within him, and so is ostracized from his village. One teacher decides to acknowledge him, blah, blah, blah. We already know that part. So Naruto becomes stronger by becoming friends with people, especially those who think they are all alone and hated by everyone. Late in the story, he befriends all of the nine-tailed beasts, and by learning their real names, by the way, the way he learns it is he makes a song out of their names, and it's such a fucking, like, catchy, fun song. I love it. Sorry, I'm geeking out. The reason that allowed him to befriend them is no one else has bothered to learn their real names, which were given to them by Hagoromo. Another reincarnation of Indra, Madara, has been working for decades to, unbeknownst to himself, to unseal Kaguya. Naruto, who has the sage power, thanks to the tailed beasts he befriended, and Sasuke, who has the Sharingan power thanks to seeing his last remaining family member die, both defeat Madara and Kaguya and seal her away again. Sasuke then vows to bring peace and order to the world through force, just like Indra did, starting again like Indra by killing his only friend Naruto. The fight ends when Sasuke, using chakra stolen from Naruto, and Naruto, using chakra given to him by the Ninetales, blow one another's arm off. Sasuke finally acknowledges Naruto as his friend, which breaks the cycle of reincarnation. So it was kind of a long explanation of a very long story, but every part is important to the narrative. So again, excluding most of the filler, nearly every detail of the anime's story is important or in keeping with the overall themes. Sasuke tackles every situation with dominance, while Naruto tackles every situation with cooperation. So even their favorite powers represent this. Sasuke uses fire and lightning, which are both very powerful and come from within. And Naruto uses clones of himself and a swirling chakra bomb, which he is only able to form using more than two hands. So at first he uses clones, and then in that final fight, he doesn't have enough chakra to make any clones. So there's actually this like scene where, you know, the chakra bomb starts off very small, and then you see like the hands of all his friends that have died like turning the chakra, helping him like defeat Sasuke. It's really cool.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's the overall story.
Okay, so the overall story, obviously, and for those who have still paid attention all this way through, like me, the overall story has a lot of symbolic meaning.
Yeah.
It is, like, it is drenched with symbolism. Not all of which is obviously obvious. But yeah, I think the whole thing has this kind of it's got a deeper story that it's busy telling about human nature, about the nature of human interaction, and it's clever that it's telling it in this way that's accessible and appealing.
Yeah, it's a superhero anime that's telling like fairly fairly important philosophical themes.
Yeah. It's awesome.
Yeah, and I guess I don't know enough about Japanese culture to say like, you know, how much this represents Japanese culture. You know, we have like this stereotype, I guess. I don't know if it's a stereotype or not even, that they're, you know, more of a collectivist culture than the West, which, you know, I think that kind of mischaracterizes both of us, because in a way that we're very collectivist in the West. You know, it's just that our version of collectivism favors, you know, billionaires, and we, you know, we were basically encouraged to indirectly lick their boots through like thinking that we're going to be like them one day. Mm. And Japan, you know, they also have, you know, a class society, so it's not like they're fundamentally different in that way, but. You know, I think they're encouraged more to help one another than to, you know, fuck one another to lift up billionaires.
Yeah, so. I think that for me, at least, when I think of the Orient, China is pretty much the only one that I view as an actual collectivist society. For me, the
I don't even know if that's true, though, because, like, you know, one, I read this article a year or two ago about, like, the mega projects in China and how there's a lot of these projects that they're essentially useless. Like, that giant, there's that giant mall. It's, like, the biggest mall in the world, and, like, no one ever goes there. Like the article was saying that one of the reasons that these projects are happening is because by completing some huge mega project, you can distinguish yourself in the, bureaucracy of the Communist Party. And so there's all these bureaucrats that are trying to make themselves stand out by like producing these big, magnificent things so that they can move up in the bureaucracy. So in a way it's very individualist. In terms of like, you know, there are people who are trying or who are social climbers and are trying to move up in the world. And I would say
okay,
that,
fair enough.
Yeah, in a way that's in some ways it's even more deleterious than what some billionaires do, because, you know, at least for, you know, a billionaire to do a mega project, it has to be used by someone, even if it's not used by like people who matter, you know.
Yeah, at least it's there is some utility in the whole thing. I think what happens in the West is the kind of collectivism that you're referring to is mostly it's what Robert Nozick.
Oh yeah, Robert Nozick. Yeah.
He coined the term utility monster, I think it was. And where he's basically describing what we would now term a billionaire, it fits the description of a utility monster, where we, as a collective society, we feed them our utility in the belief that they will make the most use of our utility. And, yeah, I suppose I can understand how the West is viewed as collectivist from that perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's like there's not one or the other answer, you know.
Fair enough. Yeah. It's never as simple as all that. Why can't it just be zero sum games and simplicity?
Why can't it just say one thing and be right about everything? God damn it.
Exactly. Where is the theory of everything?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So was there anything more you wanted to add in about Naruto?
I could talk about this other specific example that I wrote, but it's also a little long, and we're at about an hour and a half now. I'll probably edit out a bit, but like, I don't know.
Okay, there's in that case, we're going to skip the rest of Naruto. Everyone, just go watch them. Go watch 700 episodes, of which
I'll enjoy about half. I'll attach the show notes to the episode on the Post-Scarcity Magazine website. So if you want to read my synopsis and analysis of this one episode that's actually a filler episode that's very good, then you can look at that.
Okay. In the meantime, I wanted to, now that we've spoken about the various heroes in each of the cultures, I wanted to talk about what the fundamental differences between Japanese and American animation. And this is taking a slightly more generalized view of the two separate cultures.
Sure.
So in order to do this, you sort of have to look back and then you start to realize that ever since a Japanese animation crossed the continents and became popular with generations of American viewers, there's been a lot of contention online as to which is superior, Japanese or American animation. And I mean, for me, I'm not sure that you can really call one or the other superior. I find that it's like comparing Marvel to DC. Marvel does what it does really well. DC does what it does really well. But the two don't really compare very well. Yes, they are touching on very similar content, but the look and the feel and the overall story arcs and everything, there's too many differences and not enough similarities for the two to be compared properly.
Yeah.
Now, to depict this with the Japanese versus American animation, I think the easiest answer when looking for what is the difference is the style. Obviously, the visual look and feel of Japanese animation versus American animations is mostly evident in the design of human characters. In Japan, you've got the distinctive large eyes with numerous reflective highlights and detailed color. And that's like a hallmark of anime. I mean, obviously,
if you learn to draw anime, that's the first thing you do is draw some character with giant eyes.
Yeah. And I mean, then there's also the very small noses, the very small mouths until they laugh or scream. And then suddenly you've got the gigantic South Park Canadian mouth. And I mean, even certain styles that favor unrealistically broad and generous mouths depict them using minimal lines. So the style itself uses many angles and flowing lines, like attenuated lines. Mm. Stuff like eyelashes, hair, clothing are depicted in more fine detail. And the color often uses more variance and shading with a lot more attention paid to non-outlined highlights and shadows so as to add more depth. This is in contrast to the American animation, where it either falls into attempts at comic book style realism, as realistic as that can get anyway, or it becomes grossly exaggerated comical cartoon characters with rounded, highly exaggerated features. So in American animation, there's usually less detail. It's focused instead on using tricks of style to imply the detail in more subtle and understated fashion. And there's less attention to shading instead of solid block colors, save for, in dramatic scenes that specifically require it. So where American animation may seem to lack in that aspect, though, it does make up for it in the amount of animation that's done.
So you're American saying, like, the movement aspect?
Well, yeah. If you go watch any of the Japanese anime series, you'll find a lot of the animation is what I would consider cheat.
Real quick, I should have done this earlier, but let's clarify, are you, because there's been a very major turn in how animation is done for both, really, which is the advent of computer graphics. So,
of course,
you know, cell animation is very, very different than computer graphic animation.
Of course.
So,
but again, the two different styles of American versus Japanese are reflected in this technological shift, if you want to call it that, where Western animation has very strongly focused on getting high resolution, full motion across the entire picture, where every single detail on that picture is in motion. What you see in the Japanese stuff is a lot of the screen, a lot of the picture is still, with very minute details moving. So this would, from an animation
This is especially true in cell animation. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And this little trick of Japanese animation, the style, actually means that they can push out a lot more content than what you can do with American style. Yeah. Which is one of the reasons why Japanese anime has so much more content than what you're getting out of the American market. The American market manages to push out a fair amount of animation, and they compete on the international level, but they're nowhere near the level of content, the sheer volume of content being pushed out by Japan.
The other major reason for this is that Japan is a island country. It doesn't have a whole lot of land, and so animation studios are much more practical for them to use than film studios. Which is why they don't have much of a film industry, but they have this huge animation industry.
Mm, definitely. Those are my biggest differences between the two industries as a whole. Mm-hmm. But I do can't find this set of notes I had now.
When you were just saying about how they animate in anime, I was just thinking that that could actually be like one of the reasons why Japanese superheroes tend to feel so much more like super, is that like when they're doing these fight scenes, like in Dragon Ball Z, for example, you know, a lot of the fight scenes, they're not really animating the action. They're animating these little like blur effects where they're like, they're like dashing around super fast and like dealing these super fast blows, so all you really see are the impacts of the blows, or maybe not even that. You just see like flashes of them, which is much easier to animate, obviously, than like a guy going a million miles an hour and, you know, hitting another guy at a million miles an hour. But it gives you a sense of, you know, Goku and Vegeta being like extremely powerful, so fast that you can't even see them. Whereas for American cartoons, you always see the action.
Agreed. The style does lend itself to creating a more powerful feel for characters.
Yeah.
Okay, so I found a really good article, and I've taken some notes from there. And basically, it breaks down very quickly 13... differences between Western and Eastern superheroes. So now we're stepping away from the Eastern, and we're just jumping. And this sort of, it relates to everything we've been saying, and it might build on some of what we've already said. But yeah, I just want to go through this very quickly.
Cool.
Okay, so the big first difference is in the West, the heroes are based on fake science.
Okay.
So... like Barry Allen and the Speed Force, or Captain America and the Super Soldier Serum.
Okay,
it's fake science.
There's a few exceptions, like Dr. Fate and Dr. Strange, but yeah, I think that's a pretty fair statement.
Yeah. Whereas in the East, a lot of it is based on fake mysticism. So it's got more to do with spirituality, willpower, meditation, and intellectual realizations. So it's got less to do with the hard sciences, and it's got more to do with this spiritual woo kind of stuff.
Okay, interesting.
Okay, the second one is that your Western superheroes, I touched on this before. Most of them, their powers are gifts given to them. It's something that they either have as a birthright, or they stumble onto it and they get lucky and all of that. Whereas in the East, it's all about growth. It's all about learning new stuff. It's about having that internal need and then making insane efforts to get better at it.
Which is taken almost to a parody level in like Gurren Lagann.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, the third one is that in the West, you've predominantly got single-level powers. And by that, I mean they can't really dial up their power beyond a certain threshold. Whereas in Eastern heroes, they keep getting power-ups throughout the series. Like Naruto, like Kurosaki Ichigo, like Shun,
like Dragon Ball Z.
Like Dragon Ball Z. So they have to train, obviously. There's the growth thing, but it's all this next level of power and this next level of power. To me, that's a very obvious and very big difference. Okay, the fourth one is that it's complex powers versus simple power. You know, none of the Western superheroes have a single simple power. They are, like Superman, is the best, the strongest, the fastest, so on and so forth. Batman has his wealth, but he also has gadgets, vehicles, weapons, training, all sorts of stuff. It's this wide array of stuff. Whereas Eastern heroes usually have a single power, which is simpler than most other characters, even in the same universe. Like, if I think of Gantagan, or, again, Ichigo Bankai.
Yeah.
I remember it. Yeah. They tend to have the singular power, and that's their sole focus, and it's
they're the best at that thing that they do.
At that
like Vash
one
the Stampede,
thing.
I think, is a good example of that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, obviously there are exceptions in the Western side. Flash has got speed, and that's about it. He is kind of clever because he's a scientist at heart, but not even all that much.
What's your power? I like to go fast.
I like to run.
I'm the fastest
everywhere.
Guy.
My name is Barry Allen, and I'm the fastest man alive. Shut up, Barry. No one cares. Okay, the fifth major difference is that in Western, obviously there are some major exceptions to this one, but I have found that even within the exceptions, I think this is still true. In the West, you have high-powered loners, whereas in the East, you have groups.
Yeah, absolutely.
So in the West, even your groups, like the X-Men, have these high-powered loners where you've got Wolverine, you've got Jean Grey, you've got Rogue, you've got... And they're all these single characters whose powers don't really complement anyone else in the group. They work together, but there's never really any kind of functional teamwork.
I can't think of any like cool like combo attacks that that some of the X-Men have.
Yeah, definitely, you know? Not. You know, whereas you switch across and you go and look at Dragon Ball Z, and I mean it's so intrinsic that they have to all work together.
And they always have a most powerful group member, but they are always a group.
And I mean, part of the entire story is that someone's going to die and Goku's going to have to go and fight again and die with them and go and learn more stuff, and they're going to have to combine powers and
Yeah, I think One Piece is a great example because they're explicitly like a crew, and they work together very well.
Yeah. Another really good example of this is Boku no Haram, My Hero Academia.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Where literally they are taught almost from the word go on how to work together. It's it's an actual, here, go to school and learn how to be a part of a superhero team, where it's all about teamwork and learning to figure out your powers together.
And I love that they put Deku and what's his name, his rival together, like the two like worst possible people to be on a team. Force them to be a team. That was great.
Yeah. I absolutely love that series.
Yeah. Highly recommend My Hero Academia. Both of us do.
Definitely. Okay. The next major difference is that in the West, there's no mentors. Whereas in the East, there are always mentors.
Yeah.
Obviously, again, exceptions to the rule. But even the exceptions with... And I don't really think of Professor Xavier as a mentor, because he doesn't.
He's
really
more of like
do
a founder character.
Yeah. So there's no mentors really that are teaching these heroes how to utilize their powers and how to. There's guides and spiritual guides and Superman.
God, I never thought of this.
Yeah. Whereas,
and like these are some of the most classic characters I think in anime. It's like. You got Master Roshi, King Kai, Kakashi Sensei, Might Guy. Fuck, like they're like the mentor characters are always so good.
Yeah, so in the East, you've always got this master apprentice kind of vibe, whereas in the West, it's always this lone hero again, building on that. The next big one for me: shared universe versus independent universe. So in the West, all the Western superheroes, they sort of belong to a larger universe. It's almost like companies like Marvel and DC and whatnot, where they basically accounted for everything in the kitchen sink. The universe has, instead of telling individual stories, they sort of go, well, within this universe, this we can toss this in as well, and that'll create more intrigue. And I mean, it makes it great for when you're trying to do a 20-movie, four-phase project that's going to bring in $20 million. But it's not so great when you've got an audience that's trying to identify really good stories that have a solid beginning, middle, end. Whereas the moment you go across to the East... they usually have standalone stories and universes that don't interact with each other. Mm-hmm. You don't see Naruto crossing over into Dragon Ball Z, and you don't see Appleseed existing in the same universe as Evangelion. And you know what I mean?
I think Gundam is the one exception to that.
Yeah, but Gundam, and I don't know, I felt like they fell off the bandwagon.
They do break a lot of
but I also think it's got to do with the fact that they centered a lot around working with the Star Wars themes. They were already trying to emulate the West, so to expect them to sort of stick to Japanese and the East kind of philosophy and storytelling, that's a bit far-fetched. Okay, moving right along. The eighth big difference that I can think of is that in the West, it tends to be all about crime fighting, whereas in the East, it's usually about a single villain or threat. Essentially, Western superheroes fight like a variety of injustice, villains, aliens, other superheroes, etc., whereas Eastern superheroes are fighting one villain or threat at a time. And the end of at the end of any of those story arcs, it's an end to the entire story, and if there's more to come, then it starts up a new story. It's not like this continuous threat, and Lex Luthor is going to keep coming back, and Batman's never going to kill the Joker. Oh my god. Okay. Very big one here. Very big one. And there are, again, exceptions, but not nearly enough for it to be considered anything but a rule. In the West, it is a white male. It is almost exclusively a white male.
Yep.
Whether we're talking about Hal Jordan or Clark Kent or Bruce Wayne or
Peter Parker.
Peter Parker, yeah. Tony Stark, Steve Rogers. They're all white men. And they're always the great man myth, which we've mentioned on the show a couple of times now. They are the perpetuation of the great man myth. The idea that one white guy is going to save the world. And yeah, obviously this has long-ranging effects. Whereas in the East, they work in teams. So they tend to have all sorts of genders, sexualities, ages, races, species.
Black people, green people.
Yeah, it's a smorgasbord of characters. Okay, I have mentioned before about the never-ending rehashes in the West versus coherent stories with beginning and end in the East. So I won't mention that again. Or did I just mention it again? I think I did.
You mentioned it in the first half.
Yeah, and then I just mentioned it again.
Oh, now. Yeah. But, I mean, it's like probably the most distinguishing feature between the two.
Yeah. Okay, so just two more to go. No, three more to go. Equal heroes versus a hierarchy. All powers in Western stories are at essentially the same level, which means that in any story, Flash's speed can beat Superman, and Superman's strength can beat Flash. There's no real clear winner. This is also because each of these characters throughout the decades have had different writers. Eastern stories, on the other hand, with a single writer, tend to be clear in terms of who is stronger, who is faster, etc., with usually no real room for debate about it. No one really questions the fact that One Punch Man is going to beat the crap out of everyone.
I would say the exception would be Batman with planning can beat anyone. And no one can really dispute that.
Please don't get me started on the Batman thing.
Not just Batman. Batman with planning.
Okay. Okay. Batman with prep time. Literally the worst argument that it's possible to have in the nerdverse.
But it was my favorite meme from the early 2000s, so I have to bring it up.
definitely. It's a trope. It's a trope. Yeah, it's what makes Batman fans the worst people in the universe, next to Rick and Morty fans.
What about Batman fans with planning?
Okay, moving right along before I get upset. In the West, you tend to have fulfilled wishes versus in the East, where everything is innocent and joyful. Now, what I mean by this is that Western heroes are more about wish fulfillment, as in, if I had powers like those, with a dash of be careful what you wish for thrown in. In the East, the superheroes are more playful, they're more innocent, they have friends, and their life is more than just their powers and their responsibility.
Yeah, I think that goes back to what I mentioned right in the very beginning, which is that Western superheroes have this separate identity from themselves as a person. Mm. That
definitely
sounds
100%. Yeah. Okay. And then the very last thing that is on my list for today is instinct versus training. The Western story trope follows a basic linear progression. There's danger, then there's normal reaction, then there's failure, then there's letting go of self, and then there is victory. Eastern story tropes have more of a danger than normal reaction than failure. Then going back to basics and training, and then eventually leading to some kind of victory.
So it's kind of like the hero's journey with extra steps, sounds like?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So Western traditions give more importance to instinct, while Eastern ones place more trust in training and discipline and, you know, it, again, we're back to the growth thing. Growth versus gift.
Mm.
You know, the West seems to say that unless you're born with it, you're never going to have it.
Yeah, and Superman doesn't get any more super than... I mean, he does, I guess, through, like, different generations of writers for the story, but, yeah. Like, he's not, like, training to become a more powerful version of Superman.
Exactly. Like, even I've seen one or two animations of him exercising by lifting a weight, which is basically just testing what he's capable of.
Yeah.
Where he's lifting 200 quintillion tons or something. And
then, like, yeah. You know, I guess you could say that Iron Man could be an exception, but, like, what he's doing isn't really training. He's upgrading his technological ability, yeah. You know?
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. So, yeah, that's my major differences between the heroes. And now that I have enlightened everyone, they're going to look at everything in a very different light. Yeah. Yeah, if only I could get through to capitalists like this.
Well, I think that was a pretty fun show.
I think so, too.
We covered a lot. Yeah.
Definitely. And now, I do think we need to, once we're done with the show today, I think we both need to get on the line and chat to Marvel and DC and several of the Japanese companies.
President DC.
We need to chat to them and see what our royalties are going to be for the increases in their revenue after people listen to our show and then run off to get themselves some subscriptions to comics.
I was hoping to get a sponsorship from Toei Animation.
Okay. I'm trying to figure out what you're going to do with a sponsorship.
Buy you a new mic.
Oh my god. Go do it. Okay, everyone. So, as usual, if you want to check out us on Twitter, you can find Ryan at Handle of Rye. You can find myself. I have finally got a decent Twitter handle that is actually findable.
Hooray.
You can find... Yeah, you can find me at Bookchenite.
I thought it was Bookcheekite.
Oh yes, it is Bookcheekite. Sorry, I nearly sent people running after someone else.
They're probably okay to follow too.
yeah, probably. Yeah, you can find me at Bookcheekite, and then you can go and follow the podcaster at NeighborSciPod. You can also find us on Facebook. For the Neighbors Science page and anywhere
and
else.
Also on the web, postscarcitymagazine.com, that has both this podcast. It has nicer looking details about the episodes than you'll probably see in your podcast app. And then it also has the fantastic Postscarcity magazine, which currently has 5 issues. It's by me and a handful of other people. It has more like long form essays, some comedy stuff as well, some cool art, lots of anime references in the art. yeah, so I recommend that. I'm thinking of starting up another one pretty soon, so maybe we'll have episode or issue 6 before a couple months from now.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to that.
Yep.
Okay, people. Thank you for joining us. And we shall bid you adieu.
Bye.
せろ急ぐ四つ溶岩熱いぜ孫悟空五ついつでも駆け足悟空を六つ無理せず慌てて再現七つ七不死空飛ぶ丁寧八つやっぱりウィーだぜ勇気九つ古今と最強クラマとうとう揃った美獣の仲間次は陣中力いくってばよ一つひどい熊だよガーラ二つふにゃんと猫なで雪と三つ水影四代目のヤグラ四つ四十年四ビート老子五ついかついパワーの半無口な気流し疑った七つなど息子の一風八つやばいよラップのきらび九つこの葉の渦巻きなるととっても強い陣中力のみんな美獣と仲良くなれるかなみんな立派な獅